everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. Here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing new ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. On yesterday's program, we did a remarkable reporting on overreacting. When people have these major overreactions and when they become besides themselves. You know, basically where you just don't have all of your tools available and you're just reacting. And you can be reacting with either anger or despair or grief or whatever. And we talked about it. We talked about the chemistry of it. If you didn't hear that program, go into the archives and hear it. It's a very, very, I think, very important piece of information. So it was called Overreacting, I believe. But something came to my attention. A book called My Mind Is Not Always My Friend. And it caught my mind, it caught my eye, and I asked myself, what is this? And as I looked through it, a man named Stephen Fogel is an author, and he wrote an almost common sense book about how to deal with your mind when your mind becomes the enemy. And I thought, well, here's a non-professional approach to something that we've been talking about scientifically for ages. And as I looked through it, I said, well, this is as professional as most therapists I know. In the studio with me, Stephanie Dombra. Stephanie.
Hi, Armand.
Good to have you back here. And Stephen Fogel. Stephen.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Good. Stephen, My Mind Is Not Always My Friend. What do you mean by mind?
Well, to me, the mind is basically the voice in my head that's talking to me all the time.
Okay, it's a voice.
Yes, it's a voice.
It's what you're thinking.
Yeah, my point of view about it is that we have hardware in our head and we have software. And the hardware is the various mechanical parts, and the software is what we program it with. And those are our thoughts and our memories.
All right. Our thoughts and our memories, so let me see if I can understand that. It's hardware. So there is stuff imprinted there that's long-term stuff? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, well, I believe that when we're born, we have things that are pre-programmed in, our reflexes that we're afraid of, putting our hand in a flame, and we pretty much come in with a blank canvas other than those reactions. And then with the blank canvas, we create our own universe by the way we adapt to things and the way we categorize them. So some of us really, if you're asked if you like the heat better or the cold better, some of us like one, some like the other, and it's just the way we've programmed it into our own system.
Okay, so once it gets programmed in our system, you believe that our mind, our very thinking, can become our enemy.
It's our friend most of the time. And by the way, let me take you back.
Let's go back to how it's your friend.
Yeah. First I want to say that I believe that the mind has one job, and it goes back thousands and thousands of years, and it's to keep us safe. It's for our survival. I also believe that when we were in the hunter and gatherer state, we needed to have our own little village, and we lived in tribes. And if to forage for food, you needed plenty of people to look for it. If you were by yourself, you may not find it every day. And when a predator or a dangerous situation came along, your tribe could help you deal with it. On your own, you probably couldn't. So the biggest thing that we needed for our survival then was to fit in, and so our tribe didn't ostracize us. So from that day till now, I do not believe in that respect that instinct of fight or flight and trying to keep in your tribe is any different. And one of the things I am now totally amused by, and this includes myself, is how most of us are on our cell phones and our internet constantly, and that's because we want to stay in good stead with our tribe.
Okay, so it's a very interesting perception. Right? You think that we're keeping our tribal contact.
Oh, yeah. Like, I'm a businessman, and if some of the people I email in my own company, if they respond to me in a relatively appropriate period of time, I don't think twice about it. If they don't get back to me on something important, then I think, hey, these guys, they're not a team player.
Interesting, Steph.
Well, it's interesting because, yes, of course, we were talking about this even a few days ago, that the use of all our technology just exaggerates it, in my estimation, that idea that let's wait for that email, and if it doesn't come to us in 3 hours, something's wrong, whereas maybe with snail mail and phone calls, we might not be as connected in the past because we didn't have the ability to be so connected. So I just wonder,
so I wonder
what it's
if
actually
there wasn't
doing
a major advantage to not being connected, so you can be connected to yourself. You know what I mean?
Well, it all depends on your temperament and your personality, and like you say, your hardware inside. If you want to be quiet and be a loner versus someone that's always connected, a social type or an extroverted type or an introverted type.
Well, one of the things I would add to that is that the way we want to be a good member of our tribe is very unique to each one of us. Some of it do it by being people pleasers, and some of us do it by being jokesters. But some of us do it by being bullies, and some of us do it by holding back and withholding and making them come toward us. So there's a whole variety. There's a cafeteria to choose how your character plays it. But everybody's unique, and everybody wants to be in that tribe.
Now, with everybody wanting to be in that tribe, we go to your book. Your mind is working at trying to keep you safe. And keeping you safe means to be a part of the tribe the way you're most comfortable being part of the tribe, which means you could be an isolate and still be a member of the tribe that way.
Of course. But one of the other things that your mind is doing is your mind is always predicting. Pretty much when you are in your mind, you are always thinking of something in the past or you are thinking of something in the future. You're never really present when that voice is coming to you, and it predicts and predicts and predicts, and it's always taking stances to ward off whatever it believes is a threat.
Once I coined a phrase, what once was, is, and will always be is the way the mind works. Whatever happened in the past is probably going to happen in the future. Therefore, I'm all set to deal with that future.
Totally agree, because what it turns out to be is we become past-based people, and we don't want to be past-based people, but we don't know that our communication system, that voice in the head, is only using experiences that has previously recorded. Whether it's using them in a correct situation or an incorrect situation is when it's your friend and when it's not your friend. When it pulls out a file that correctly deals with its perceived threat, it's your friend. When it pulls out a file that it mislabeled and applies it to what it perceives as the oncoming threat, then it's not your friend.
Okay,
it's preventing you.
We've got to talk about that. My guest is Stephen Fogel. The name of the book, My Mind Is Not Always My Friend. So there's a perception that your thinking, we're going to take your thinking and call that your mind. And your thinking is applied based on what you've done in the past. Now, there are times that this works against you, and part of the way that I think you propose is that we misinterpret the things that happened in the past.
I'll give you an example of it. If someone's mother or father was really strict with them, and they felt that strictness was very uncomfortable for them growing up, when they have a boss in the future, and the boss, in their perception, is really strict with them, they are going to be nervous, uncomfortable, and probably run away from doing what that boss wants them to do. So just that remembrance of strict is bad will prevent them in the future and create a future just like their past, as opposed to if they kind of understand that strictness really doesn't apply anymore and they reprogram that way of thinking in their mind, then there's a lot of possibilities with that boss. But without reprogramming, there's only fear.
So if you base your present based on your past, and the past was a misinterpretation, see, this is what some of the things we did were mistakes. But to give an example, if somebody gets a job and they're young and the job is stressful and they deal with, let's say they had a bad early childhood, they had a critical father, they get a job and their boss is critical or slightly critical or criticizes them. So they look at that and they don't know that they're really reacting to their past. And they just say, I'm not going to take this from anybody, and they quit. And when they walk out, they're deeply relieved from having left the job. Now, here's the problem.
Yeah. And
the problem is that you made a mistake in your thinking. You shouldn't have quit that job. You should have dealt with your misinterpretation.
Yeah. One of the other things that I want to add to that is that the voice in our head, which I refer to as the mind, is incredibly territorial. It does not want to hear it's wrong. It wants to believe what it believes. And one of the things that's really, really important is as we become more advanced in how we look at life is that we start to understand that that voice is kind of our board of directors. It's like the President of the United States has a Defense Department, and he also has a Secretary of State. He has a choice of listening to which one. One is often saying, I want to bomb the people, and the other is often saying that, no, I think we should be patient and try and repair the situation. So if you are the President of the United States in your own mind, and if the only part you were listening to is that part that says bomb them, and you don't know you have a choice of another part of you that's saying, let's be nice to them, then you're in a real dilemma. You have to choose, but the voice doesn't want you to choose. The voice wants you to follow its instructions.
Yesterday we did a report on how the amygdala, the brain, the part of the brain that winds up giving us the fight-or-flight reaction, how the amygdala, when it gets fires, which means when you're in a reaction, a nervous reaction, through the hippocampus cuts off the higher consciousness of the rest of your mind. So when you are in that place, when you're in a nervous, overreactive place, and somebody says something to you that would counteract what you're saying. So let's say you say, last week you told me this, da, ba, 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 and you say to them, no, I didn't say it. Here's the proof of it. They don't care. They never want to be wrong because the amygdala is going to keep firing and keep firing, and it doesn't have available to it the reasoning that you would like it to have. So reason is not an antidote to the misfire of the mind. What do you propose we do, Stephen? What do you propose people do when they see their minds going off at edges?
What I've learned for me is, and it took a lot of coaching until I really got this, is to monitor my body. I find that I hold my breath a lot. When anything comes along that voice in my head is really championing, that's scary for me, I'll hold my breath. Another thing I do is I notice I start with a tick where I'll start choking or I'll start taking in big sighs like that. And so I've learned to monitor those cues with myself. And when I monitor them, then what I do is I start breathing. And I really focus on my breathing and calm myself down. And that usually breaks the circuit. And I can start trying to see what happens. The next thing I do when I realize that's happening, I look and see what actually happened as opposed to the way I'm interpreting it. An example of that is I was in a phone call this morning where it was a disturbing phone call, and I went right back to being abusive to the person on the other end of the phone. I caught myself in maybe 2 or 3 seconds, and I started to say, now what set me off? This was not that big a deal. And then I really took the moment and said, what really happened? And what the person really did wasn't a big deal to me, but I didn't like that when I was a kid when anyone talked to me like that, and it scared me. And so I reacted tough, and as soon as I did that, I took note of it and changed my attitude.
Yeah, I guess Stephen Fogel, well, it would mean that after a period of time, you have been able to develop the distance enough so that you notice. You know, everybody, we would almost assume that all we have to do is teach people, well, why don't you breathe whenever you're under fire? But they can't.
Yeah.
See, when you're lost in that kind of tirade, and when you're lost in that place, you don't have access to the reason of your mind. What do you think, Steph?
I think it's always a conflict. If you just even think about the structures that I often use this example, which really taught me about this whole problem of the emotional brain versus the thinking brain, the amygdala sets off this entire signal of being afraid, and it's like a superhighway of all sorts of signals coming out saying react and be afraid and be scared and all that. And then when we get to this point, and I think it's interesting, we have to look at this hippocampus connection. Once it gets to the reasoning part of our brain, that brain part needs to send the signal back to the amygdala to say, calm down. Guess how big that lane is? It's a one-lane highway. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult for the part of the brain that's telling us, quiet down, it's okay. It takes longer to get back to making us quiet our amygdala. It takes just much longer than the reactivity.
I bet if you get older, it happens faster. You know what I mean?
It does. I think that the training, which is what we do here in this work and the radio and all the work that we do with our clients and people, we help them to understand that. So the breathing technique is a perfect example that if you even start to see yourself react, you know that's the thing going on in your brain. You got to just say, wait a minute, I'm going to go into a full-blown, like, angry state. You can catch it.
Some people can, and some people can't.
That's right.
Well, let me give a little example that's a little less charged that I found for myself. I am an artist as one of my activities, and I paint portraits, and often I take a lot of pictures of the subjects, and I'll work from the photographs that I've taken of the subject. And sometimes I will notice that I have a stroke in a very intricate part of the face, and I will paint it. And I didn't come to understand till recently, I take it so seriously that I hold my breath. The fact that I'm holding my breath, I can only paint for about 8 or 9, maybe 20 seconds, and then I have to stand back and look, and I lose a lot of it. So I've now trained myself to keep knowingly breathing in and out while I'm doing that intricate painting, and it allows me to paint. But that's something I've trained myself to do.
So as I think here's the, a lot of people come to me to consult with me, and they come for a consultation, and very often I'll look at somebody, and I'll see, well, they're in a certain place in life, but, and I'll say this very thing to them, you know, 6 years from now, you're probably going to be much calmer than you are now. And 6 years from now, this which seems like a problem is going to seem like baby stuff to you. So 6 years from now, you're going to be better. The only thing that you might do in therapy is speed up the process. You know, time makes such a difference. Think about the young child who is hysterical over the loss of a toy. When we know, hey, tomorrow you're going to have a new toy and you won't be upset at all. Time makes such a difference. One of the advantages of getting older is you are able to make that connection between your breath and your observation of yourself. And I think older people are calm, 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 and then you get, you know, then after a while, your brain just says, I give up completely and I don't have to be here at all.
Bill Cosby did a routine years ago that I loved, right on the point where he says the difference between an old person and a young person, and then he sets a picture of, in Central Park, a young mother has her kid who gets in the water and she gets hysterical about it, and the old person, the same situation, they have a Kleenex and they have a lifesaver. As soon as the kid gets in the water, they pop the lifesaver in the kid's mouth, they give him the Kleenex, and there's no problem.
When you have self-destructive ways of thinking and acting, what do you recommend? How do you recognize them?
Again, for myself, and pretty much everything I've written is my own personal experience. For myself, the biggest clue is how I'm happening. By the way, I had an experience that changed my life. Years ago, I was in therapy with a teenage daughter, and it was for her benefit, and there was me, my wife, and my former wife, the kid's mother. After the therapy session, there was logistics, who's going to pick up the kid and this and that. We come back the next week, and my former wife says, Steve, you were screaming at me after the session. And I said, no, I've had plenty of therapy. I was the prince of the whole thing. You were the nut. And the therapist in the session says to my daughter, well, was he screaming? Yeah, Dad. Ask my current wife. Are you screaming? Yeah. I had no clue that I was screaming. And once I learned that lesson, that I was totally oblivious to I was screaming and I had purged that whole possibility from my mind, that changed everything for me. Prior to that, when people said I did things that I knew I didn't, I believed the voice in my head. Once I had that experience, I no longer trusted the voice in my head in those situations.
Well, that's kind of a very important point. You know, do you trust your thinking? Thinking is such a funny thing. It kind of, like you said, it kind of runs to keep you where you are. It kind of protects you. It keeps predicting the future. Can you trust your thinking? And so often, you know, if you're obsessive compulsive, if you're phobic, if you're paranoid, your thinking is really gone awry.
Yeah, but there are cues to that, too. Like, I notice as a businessman, whenever I need to be right, whenever I need to win in a discussion or in how we should handle something, it's a clue to me that I'm off, you know, that I need to look back at my thinking. Because when that voice in my head has to win, that's, again, a clue that I'm not, that it's just survival-based and it may be my nose cutting off my face.
Well, that's a good point because one of the things that we very often, just one second, one of the things that we very often, one of the things that we very often happen is when couples come for therapy. When a couple comes for therapy, one of the things that they very often do is you'll see them having a discussion, but it's a battle, it's a power struggle. One is trying to be right and the other is wrong. And in every discussion, in some of the best discussions I've had in my life, or the most important discussions I've had in my life, the ones that were difficult were the ones where I was trying to be right.
Yeah, well, that's the voice in the head. When I'm trying to be right, it's the voice in my head being territorial, that somehow I always equated that if I was right, I was safe, and if I was wrong, they're going to throw me out. I didn't understand the throwing the out part until much later, but that's what was going on.
This is Armand DeMille with you with Stephanie Dombra. Steph?
Well, I often will suggest to people if they're in the battle or the throes of an argument with someone, and they often do exactly what you said. I'm not screaming. That's like so classic. Get a tape recorder if you can even get to this point when before you start arguing or you know you're going to have a discussion, you just turn that tape recorder on. It is absolutely amazing when a person hears themselves talking. They get it. They finally get it because they're not getting the message from someone else that says the you thing, like you always say, Armand. They hear it and they can't deny it unless, you know, to me, I think there's all sorts of reasons why people have denial and that could be really severe mental illness. But barring those kind of things, they hear it and they can start to change.
Yeah, for me, another of the clues of the tics is when I realize that I'm being defensive about anything, I know that something isn't right in how I'm approaching it.
Defensive, and how do you know you're defensive?
Oh, you can. I know.
What do you call? What do
well,
you call
for me, when I'm arguing, when I'm trying to say, no, you don't understand. Oh, let me show you another way of doing. Oh, I don't think I'm expressing myself clearly. Any of those things are defensive, and when you've had enough therapy, you get very, at least I've gotten very sly with my defensiveness. You think you can really manipulate everything by my use of language, but the bottom line is, if my lips are moving, there's a problem in most of the cases.
The problem is that if you're still talking, you're not being honest. Is that what it means? You're reacting, but not honestly.
Yes, and I'm not open to really hear what's being said. One of the things I've come to understand about me, and I think it's a lot of people, is that we hear what we expect to hear. We see what we expect to see, and the voice in my head twists around whatever's being said to fit in the package it expects.
Yeah.
I see that a lot with everybody, myself, others. We have these cases, I think, when we are talking to somebody, we have ideas, and we want to almost fetch out to kind of convince or defend our ideas or arguments, even if they're not wrong in the face of reality.
I know something I'm personally going through now is the process of my business is 40 years old, and I've been the CEO of it jointly with my founding partner. And now I find that I've reached the point where the Peter principle, where I know where I've risen to my level of incompetency, but I don't want to give up, and I don't want the other younger executives. It bothers me sometimes that when they say go to the left, and I want to go to the right, and I realize, hey, wow, this is the voice in my head that's not willing to start sitting in the back seat and enjoying the ride.
Just describe what that Peter.
Peter principle.
Yeah, let people understand.
Yes,
that.
The Peter principle says that we all eventually rise to the level where we are incompetent and no longer are as good as we think we are.
And that you believe, Stephanie, you're familiar with that, aren't you?
Yes, I see it. Yes, people talk about it. They explain it. They watch it with supervisors, and I think that could be a very frustrating dynamic in general for people in work settings, watching others that are not managing. All sorts of stories I hear from people.
Yeah, if I don't feel I'm useful and that I know more or this or something of the nature, then my next logical consequence is I don't deserve the job. If I don't deserve the job, even though I own the company, then what am I going to do? I don't want to sit home all day.
Our guest is Stephen Vogel. His book, My Mind Is Not Always My Friend, readily available. My Mind Is Not Always My Friend. It's a good recognition, Stephen. I really appreciate the work that you've done on this. Nice, and it's nice that it comes from a place of his personal development. You know, he's not preaching to other people. What he's saying is, look, this worked for me. Maybe it would work for you. The other thing that he doesn't put in his book is that as I've gotten through the years, I've gotten this sense of balance. And a sense of balance so frequently will come with people who have observed themselves. Now, observing yourself is such a difficult thing because it's so much easier to just blame the other guy.
It's also not popular. The people around me generally their own machinery has a point of view about how my machinery is operating, and personal security and that sense of self that I have always had a strong will, and I was I've been a successful businessman, and when I look back, most of the reason I was a successful businessman is because I had so much personal pain in other areas that I wanted to avoid the personal pain, and I got satisfaction out of chasing a dollar, and I was good at it. So by the time I got to the point where I didn't really need the money anymore, which in my case was in the 30s, and when I say I didn't need the money, it's that I felt relatively secure, although I'm still insecure about money. The point is that's when I started to feel the pain. That's when I ended up in the therapist's office, because I realized that, okay, now that chasing a buck isn't the solution, what am I going to do? It's unhappy out there.
Stephen, I want to thank you for being with us. This is Armand DeMille. The name of the book, as I said, The Mind Is Not Always My Friend. We are going to be taking a short break, my friends, and I'm going to play you some music today, because today I got one of my favorite old pieces of music about what it's like to not have enough, you know, and it's fine, it's fun. So we're going to be back with you in just a couple of minutes. We'll start with some music, and then we're going to take your phone calls at 212-209-2900. So we'll be right back with you, my friends.
Loudly called one meatball. Esperanza, if you please. Way to holler down the hall. You get no bread with one meatball. One meatball. One meatball. Get no bread with one meatball. The little man felt very bad. One meatball was all that he had. In his dreams he hears that call. You get no bread with one meatball. One meatball. One meatball. Get no bread with one meatball. One meatball was all that he had. One meatball. It was so very sad. Get no bread with one meatball. One meatball. One meatball. Get no bread with one meatball. The little man felt very bad. One meatball was all that he had. In his dreams he hears that call. You got no bread with one meatball. One meatball. One meatball. Get no bread with one meatball.
Roy Bookbinder, speaking about one meatball. I like that song. I like that song because it kind of reminds you of the fact that sometimes if you start off stuff that has very little with it, you can't get very much more. You know, you have a relationship that could barely hold together because it's only based on one or two factors like a business or it's all got a sexual basis, whatever it is. You can't seem to get much more out of the relationship because you're just starting off with one meatball, you know? It's just one thing. You don't get bread with one meatball. This is Armand DeMille with you with Stephanie Dombra, The Positive Mind. Minds, the plural. We were talking with someone about the mind is not always my friend, and he was talking about how the mind can work against you. And, of course, you all know about this. You all know when your mind has, the word betrayed you is big, but I mean betrayed you, when it has worked against you. You know, if you get paranoid, if you get distrustful, if you get overreactive, if you become obsessive, that's all your mind thinking funny. And when it thinks funny, and you follow it, and then you react to it, and then you live your life according to what you think, based on you trying to find some way to feel safer. But your mind is not always your best friend. And so it's very difficult to understand that what's behind your mind very often could be anything, and frequently there are chemical messengers forcing your mind in the place where it is. It could be the food you ate. It could be hormones, it could be brain transmitters, it could be any number of things that's triggering your mind into this place of unsafety, and that it sets off this weave of thinking and stuff like that. 212-209-2900, we're going to be taking your calls in just a minute. Stephanie, let's address that just a little more. When people are lost in a frenzy of overthinking, you know? I mean, there is no rule that works. There is no telling them, like, it's like trying to tell a drug addict, you should cut down on your drugs while they're drunk, while they're stoned.
Well, I think, again, if I know you ask me a lot of questions, and I come back with the explanation, the hardware explanation, as Stephen said. But when we are overthinking something, chemically we are producing excessive dopamine, and that obsessing that makes the whole kind of thinking process skewed. And you can't really trust that if you're overthinking something, all these ideas are just producing dopamine. And after a while, when you have excessive dopamine, you're not going to be able to use good reasoning. So it I'm just theorizing, but it's a similar thing of what happens when we use drugs so much. The cocaine, when we have all this excessive dopamine in our brain, we're not thinking clearly anymore. We're really in this intensely excited state, and we could get paranoid, or we could just, you know, be on a frenzy of doing an activity. So I wouldn't trust that.
So the real question that I have to ask myself is, if I can't trust my thinking, see, by the time I'm asking myself questions, I'm already connecting my upper brain or my higher brain with my amygdala. So by the time I'm saying, oh, you should settle down, oh, you should breathe, oh, this, what is it that we notice about ourselves? One of the things that you can notice is that you don't let the other person talk. You interrupt them while they're speaking. That's one of the symptoms. One of the signs that you could do is that you're finding you're talking at random. It's just like the words are flooding into your mind. You're bringing up ideas from the past. You're bringing in evidence. It's like a courtroom. Your mind is going wild. How do you tell when your mind is going wild? How do you tell it from the inside?
Well, again, all those features that all of us have experienced when we're in an argument, we are absolutely have to get those words out. We have to express it, and it may seem so reasonable, our argument, but it the urgency is like a cue that I must say this. I've got to get it out. So, and people do it in letter writing, too. There's plenty of people that just have to say it all, and yet most of the time, none of the other people receives it. We don't really have 3/4 of what we want to say to a person be heard.
Mm-hmm. So maybe one of the things that it's up to us, if you have a friend, a partner, or a lover who is gone in one of these argumentative things or blaming or lost, maybe the best thing you could do is, if they're not going to let you hold them and they're not going to let you collaborate with them, maybe the best thing for you to do is to leave the situation and tell them, I'm not going to be a part of this with you. I'm not going to argue with you. You never want to talk. I don't want to talk when you're talking like that. You know what I mean? I had a good friend who came up with the theory that if you could speak holding hands, it's the only conversation worth having. He said, if the two of you can hold hands and have a conversation, even if you're disagreeing, it's the only conversation worth having. Because if you become negative, you're not going to want to hold the other person's hand.
That's true. That something about, we've talked about this, it's hard to be compassionate when you're angry. And it's probably literally in the brain. It turns off certain mechanisms of our ability to be loving and nurturing and connected. When we're angry, we're defensive. So it's very, very hard to say, I want to be close to you when I'm angry.
Yeah. 212-209-2900. We're going to take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. How are you?
Hi there.
Well, Michael, I had a comment. I'm older now. I'm in my 50s. And when I was younger, my husband used to disappear on me. And I couldn't find him. He wouldn't call. And my children were little. And I used to have these outbursts of anger, and when he came home, I just explode, and just so scary that I even scare myself just remembering. But the thing to mention is that we don't know that you have mentioned that the other person lose respect for you. I mean, we're not together anymore, my husband and I, but it's we lost respect for each other. And the relationship died because of it. And now what happens to these poor children that have to witness all of this? Do they learn this? Is this in our genes? I wish I could help them so they won't go through the anger and the that I went through, you know?
How many children do you have?
I have two.
So you've had children who are witness to this kind of bad selecting at the very beginning, because, I mean, having a relationship with a man who goes away and doesn't come home and doesn't do it, you know, and sometimes that's cultural. Sometimes that's what his family did. Where are you guys from?
Well, he's Irish.
He's Irish, uh-huh.
And I'm Spanish.
Okay, and is it common for men and his friends to just disappear and not come home at all? Not be responsible? But what would happen is he would decide, was he drinking? Was he a drinking man?
Well, I think he was doing drugs.
Doing drugs, okay.
And I was a committed mother, you know. I work hard and I took care of the children.
Very difficult.
When he disappeared, I wasn't jealous. I was just worried about him spending her money and just disappearing and not caring. I feel sorry that we're not together anymore.
You still feel sorry that you're not together?
Yeah, and we have, like, right now we're not together, but he's still jealous of me. He's very jealous of what I'm doing, or if I go out with somebody, he will get very jealous. And I feel the same way.
What is this attachment about? It seems to be a relationship that you had with him that seems to be very primal in some kind of way. Something about it seems to be like it goes back in history. So let me ask you a question. So he's a man who was never really very available to you. Is that true?
Well, yes, we could say that, yeah.
When you were a child, did you have a father?
Yes.
Was he available to you?
Well, not really. My father was very quiet. He was always working.
So you could never really talk to your father. He kind of disappeared.
Yes.
So you had a father who wasn't present.
Well, but he was a good husband.
He was a good husband to your mother, but but he wasn't there for you.
No.
And you married a man who wasn't there for you.
But he's a good father.
But he's a good father, just like your dad. It's a funny thing, isn't it? So it sounds like in some way you're living out your past.
Exactly.
It sounds like the attachment you have to your husband is like an attachment you had to your father. And in both cases, you're probably picking the most dysfunctional part of them to relate to. You know, that your father was somebody who was quiet, removed, not available, and your husband is somebody who is quiet, removed, and not available in his own kind of way. So, you know, I hear that both of you are jealous, and both of you are possessive, but it sounds like, for the children's sake, your best bet would be to be friends, and only friends. Because the children are going to watch this struggle of you guys going back and forth all over the place.
Well, our kids are going to college now.
Oh, good. They're out.
So, I'm sure that he's very lonely because he's alone. And I'm very lonely because I'm alone.
Sounds like you got some kind of connection that you don't want to give up, and I could just fully respect it. You know, it's very hard, very hard. Something is keeping you where you get damage. And when the mind does that, it's hard to fight it. Hey, thank you for calling in.
Yes. Do you hear my question? I wonder if the children are going to carry on.
Sure, maybe they will in their own kind of way. We all carry it in some way, but many of us grow it our own way, too. And if you have two parents, the trouble that I have between you two as parents is that you are probably, because you're jealous, going to use the children in the middle between the two of you. So in other words, he's going to be asking the kids about you, and you're going to be asking the kids about him, and that's the triangulation that could damage them. But they're in an age now where the damage is already done. So the best you got is to be your most loving self, but try never to involve them in a triangle between you and your ex.
How can we help the children? Help them so they won't have this kind of life again?
Let them deal with it. They'll grow. You'll see. Okay. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you. Bye.
212-209-2900. Wow, some of those attachments you just can never break. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mr. Bimel. How are you feeling?
Good, good, good.
I must say to you, I am becoming just like you.
Good.
And the reason why I say that, only just a while back, I was having a discussion with some people, and I was saying to them, first, in order for us to make any change in our life, we must believe, disbelieve all the lies that is in our head. Because I always look like it. I always try to put it like this. You walk into a room where there's 1,000 balloons in the ceiling, falls down. And each balloon is your thought. And it seems like you are put in that room to burst every balloon until you get only one thought, and that is the present.
Hmm.
I don't know if that is a good scenario.
Sure, it's a good scenario. What did you used to be like?
Well, I was always quiet. I spoke to you already back. I was married, and I see...
Oh, what's your name?
My name is Elvis.
Elvis, of course.
Yeah, you're right. Right. I'm a very quiet person, but I don't know what can I say. I don't want to talk about myself.
Well, how have you grown, Elvis? How have you grown? How have you become more like me?
Okay, what I'm saying that from listening to your speeches that you do on the radio, as a matter of fact, most of the time when I work alone, so I have a lot of time observing myself and observing people. But most of the things that you say, for some reason, I came to that conclusion in some way, and then listening to you is like, oh, my God. I'm learning a lot about life, but yet it's revealing more me than what's out there.
Well, you know, Elvis, I kind of agree with you because most of what I say is not so insightful. I'm generally repeating what people are saying.
Right.
I believe you have all that wisdom. And so what I may do is validate it in some way.
Right,
you
know, right.
Validate your thinking.
And not crossing you, I know this is not part of it. It made me now want to become an inspirational speaker.
Good. Well, see where that takes you. Maybe you'll wind up doing a book, and then I'll have you in here as my guest on the radio.
You know something? I have fantasy about that also.
I had a feeling you did. Thank you for calling in, Elvis.
No problem.
212-209-2900. This is Armando Mia. There's so many of you out there that have such stories, that have learned so much, that know so much. That if you ever wanted to send me just a DVD, a CD, and on that CD you told me a story, you know, I'd listen. I'd listen to every one of it. You just send it to me and say, here, let me tell you a story about my life, or give me some little piece, give me something like 3 or 5 minutes long. I'd love to hear it. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille with Stephanie Dombra. We're taking your calls. We're talking about losing your mind and challenging your mind. And being out of your mind. Hi there.
Hi, Armand.
Hi there.
Hi. I listen to your program all the time, and I just tuned in. And I heard this previous lady, I think she was Oriental, talking about the problems between her and husband and how the kids are getting affected. I'm in a similar situation where I'm going back and forth as to split with my wife or not, and the kids are in the center of it. And we went to counseling a couple times, and we have, started fresh, so to speak, a couple times. But it seems like in the middle of this fight between me and my wife, my kids are just in the center of it.
Yeah.
My oldest daughter is 9, and the middle one is 6, and the baby is like 18 months.
Oh, poor kids.
And it just like I went to the courts and I got the forms to file the divorce and all that. But when I look at the kids, I'm just drawn back, and I know that things will not work out. And this is a constant struggle that I'm going through in my head. I'm really don't know what to do.
It's not easy. It's not easy. Now, does your wife understand that the children are being brought in the middle of all this?
Absolutely, she does. And you know, it's so funny because one time she told me that I hurt you by hurting the kids because I know you're going to get more hurt. And I'm saying, you know, do you know what are you doing to that kids? Do you know what they're going to look at life when they grow up, especially my older daughter when she's 9 and... Whenever we have an argument, she gets so nervous and scared, and she kind of jumps in the middle of me and my wife, and she tried to break off the argument because she knows that every argument we have is going to escalate into a fight. And it's verbal abuse, and sometimes it leads to physical.
Well, let's see, Steph, you've been in this situation with families, huh?
Well, I certainly think that since you're calling in, it's so important that you can take charge of those circumstances. Even if your wife understands this with regards to the damage it's doing to the kids, it's not irreversible. You can change this situation yourself. When the arguing starts, you just have to walk away very concretely and say, we're not going to go do this any longer.
I have done that, and a couple times I have took the kids, there was an argument, and she started to shout and yell. I mean, she has an anger problem. She gets out of control. And a couple times we got into a fight. I've taken the kids to the other room, and she would just follow me. And
yeah, well, maybe that's not the way to take the kids to the other room. Maybe what you do is if she starts yelling and losing control, you say very politely but not abusively, you say, I understand you're in that mood. I'm not going to participate. I'm going to leave. And leave her with the children. She, when you leave the room, if you take the children with you, she's got to come after you. But just find a way to release and to walk away without agitating any further, just to say, I choose not to be a part of it. Make a deal with her. Say to her in advance, I want you to know when she's not in this place, say, I'm really trying my best not to get myself involved in these arguments with you. So whenever this starts, where we get out of control, I'm going to remove myself, just as I hope you remove yourself from me. And I'm going to be back. I'll be back. I'm just going to not be a part of it. And I'll walk away. And even though you think your children are being damaged, it's going to be a lot worse if you try to pick up the kids and go out of the room. If it's that dangerous, you should call the police. You know what I mean? If it's dangerous that she's going to possibly harm the children, then of course you should have the courts involved.
I mean, I'm to a point where I've concluded, because we've been married 11 years, and this is not a short time to try a relationship. And I'm to a point where I think it's better for us to split just to save the kids. I mean, the damage is done, what's done, but it's like an...
That's one way to do it, but as Stephanie says, sometimes the one with the muscle, the one who's got the wherewithal, has got to stick in there, you know? Stick in there and just find a way to bring yourself to a calm spot, because you can. You can. If you're that concerned about the children and you're dedicated to the children's well-being, you can find a way to be present in that house in a way that doesn't build the argument. And that may require you doing work on yourself that challenges you and your reactivity. You know?
But I'm really lost, because I think I have done every possible thing.
I know you did. Good. Well, listen,
just like tonight, I don't know what I'm going to expect tonight, because it depends on her mood, how she's feeling, and that's
just
how she's feeling her life.
Just be quiet. Just be silent when you enter, and stay silent. Listen, my friend, I wish I could help you more, but you know, maybe it's something you got to discuss with somebody who's a professional. I have to be going. We're out of time. Thank you very much for calling.
You're great. Your show is really good.
Thank you. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to have to be going. We will be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m. Bye-bye for now, my friends.